Food is political. Eating is a kind of politics. We've been hearing that over the past few weeks as we've encountered the devastation of food withheld to create famine, of the laments of those under government siege, of those whose hunger blasts towards God as anger and fear. Food is political. We heard Charles Peattie talk about that last week. What you do with the land and what you do with your table, all of that is tied up in how and what and why you worship. It has something to do with nations and economies, with making war and making peace. So it should come as no surprise at all that Isaiah offers us this vision of the end of all things centering around a meal. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all people a feast of rich food, a feast of well-matured wines, of rich food filled with marrow, of well-matured wine strained clear. I used to think about Blissful Eternity as an endless U2 concert with face-melting guitar solos. But for the prophet Isaiah, the culmination of God's reconciling love looks like a feast. In the ancient world, in Isaiah's world, feasts were something provided by rulers. This is a way that a triumphant king would display wealth and power and conquest. The feast, writes Anathea Portia Young, was a hallmark of empire. Isaiah takes this cultural moment and does something interesting. Because in the vision of Isaiah, we actually hear the story of two different feasts, and both are remarkably improbable and depend on one another. The first feast remakes what would be this familiar scene in the ancient world. A conquering people and the best food spread before them by the king. The ruler shows only he is able to grant provision, that only before him are the people kept and fed. But look closer. Do you see who is there before the feast of the Lord? All people. The blessed and the cursed, the weak and the strong, the conqueror and the conquered. Rather than a vision where winners are invited in and losers are cast out, Isaiah offers us a picnic where everyone is brought together for the very best that God has to offer. This is the wine from the very back of the cellar, the most delicious cake, the crispiest fried chicken. It's a feast laid before the people. But it only happens because of a second strange and grotesque feast, one that God alone can take on. Listen again. He will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast on all people, a sheet that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. Isaiah gives us this image of God swallowing up a sheet, a shroud. It's this thing that has been covering over the people, this thick woven blanket of death, a shroud over the deceased. And this cloud, it obscures people from seeing God among them. In order for all people to feast in unity, God must swallow up death. God feasts on death. And then people are finally freed to share in the joy and the delight of God's provision. In the church, we have a name for this. It's called salvation. God takes death into God's body. The one who removes a veil that obscures our common hope and rest in God is Jesus. And so today I asked our readers to do this mashup of scriptures. We heard the words of Colossians 1 alongside the story of salvation from Isaiah. Because both tell the same story, that all things, that all people are reconciled in God. All things, all parts of creation. Everything bruised and damaged is made whole, but also those who bruise and damage are made whole. And so at this feast, we're offered a remarkable picture. Enemies of the vulnerable and the oppressed have been stripped of their enmity. They share the best of what God has to offer. We're all there together, sharing this feast, sharing the joy and intimacy of food. But for some of us, this is only tenuous good news. It sounds like good news only if you've never really had an enemy, if your life has mostly turned out right. But those aren't the people to whom Isaiah is speaking. He's talking about Israel sitting down to dinner with the people who invaded their city, who sent them into captivity. We're talking about a people who were hurt, whose loved ones were murdered, who had their cultures and communities destroyed, a people who had their ability to worship God taken away. Israel has real enemies. The pain and destruction is real. To sit down together with these murderous enemies, it's actually a terrible picture of re-traumatizing and re-entrenching oppression, unless the harm is first addressed. That was very dramatic. Oh gosh, it's getting more dramatic. It was not part of the sermon. So if we were doing the Revised Common Lectionary, that's in a lot of churches, this passage from Isaiah actually cuts off the first few verses that I included today. It jumps right to the part about feasting on the wine cellar of the Lord. But I wanted you to hear what comes first. I wanted you to understand what the condition is for sharing this joyful meal. For you have made the city a heap, a fortified city, a ruin. The palace of aliens is a city no more. It will never be rebuilt. Therefore, strong people will glorify you. Cities of ruthless nations will fear you, for you have been a refuge to the poor, a refuge to the needy in their distress, a shelter from the rainstorm, and a shade from the heat. First, God comes for the oppressed. God is for the vulnerable. God is for those who are under attack. And God turns the city of conquerors to ash. They can't rise up again. They are incapacitated from harming others. Here at Raleigh Mennonite, I think we have a strong sense of what it means to be on the side of the oppressed. We know what it means for those who have been victims of the powerful and the wealthy and the strong, what it means to be on their side. But today, Isaiah reminds us that all of creation is covered in this veil of death. The destruction of sin is more than oppressed and oppressors. It actually locks us into communal traumas. To be on the side of destruction, to have your conscience warped into believing that certain people must be destroyed in order for you to flourish, that is a moral wound on the soul of those who oppress. On Monday, our country celebrated Veterans Day. I use this occasion, as I do every year, to write to the Veterans Administration to demand an increase of funding for the vastly underserved people who return from fighting our nation's wars. We have a military budget in this country that exceeds the GDP of most countries. And yet our country continues to abandon those who they send to kill for the political interests of our nation. We hear this in the news all the time. These scandalous stories that emerge from the Walter Reed Medical Center, the crisis high number of veteran suicides, the rate of homelessness and joblessness among vets. I suppose that perhaps to an outsider, my investment in veteran health may be curious to those who have an idea about what pacifism is. Mennonites are pacifists. We don't participate in the military, and we work towards undoing the political forms that lead to military intervention. I can't speak for all pacifisms, but I can speak for what it means for me to follow the nonviolent, self-giving love of Jesus. I can speak as one who believes with my whole being that God has reconciled all things to God in Jesus. And this means that veterans are also victims. They are victims of systems of war. They are victims of the politics of war. They are often victims of poverty that leads to enlistment. And when they return, they often suffer a wound called moral injury. In our recent wars, like the war against ISIS in Afghanistan and Iraq, it's not always clear who the enemy is. Civilians and soldiers are not easily distinguishable. And it is not uncommon for soldiers to be asked to make terrible choices to follow commands. When these commands conflict with religious belief or human good or require the person to pull apart a piece of their identity and set it aside, there's a kind of tearing that happens. That tearing is called moral injury, and it can be as significant as physical or psychological injury. I suspect that in the decades to come, we'll see an expansion of the definition of moral injury. What does it mean to have been killed for an immoral war? One we later discover was fought over oil or to enlarge the U.S. presence in a region. How can a person be made whole when they put their life on the line only to find out they were actually on the side of the powerful all along? We can act with condemnation and ridicule upon those who've walked this path. We can shame and reject. Or we can return to the God we meet in the prophecy of Isaiah and in the letter to Colossians. The reason Mennonites have been consistently against war, against military participation, is that we believe God's desire for people is to be freed from causing death and destruction to our neighbors. We believe that God has reconciled all things, that a new world is possible. And to participate in destruction of God's beloved is its own kind of hell. But in Jesus, God swallows death. God takes into God's body our enmity and our trauma, both for those who cause oppression and those who suffer for it. Only with this act of God's self-giving is the veil of death finally lifted. Only then can we gather around the meal that God intended for us. What I think this might mean for Mennonites is that we stand up for underserved people, who are often veterans in our community, who would have the physical and mental health resources to recover from trauma and moral injury. It means that we need to be careful, non-judgmental listeners to veterans. Our abiding belief in who Jesus is calls us to assist in returning and integrating veterans into our communities. It also means that we continue to develop the moral integrity to be able to hold together, being for the oppressed and the desire to be people that people would be freed from the shackles of violence. It would be a terrible act of injustice for God's people in Isaiah to forgive and forget, to think this was all a misunderstanding or to hide their fear or their anger. Only God can swallow the shroud of death. Justice, not vengeance. Repentance and reparation. Truth-telling and penance. That's the work that we have to do. We too are called to this freedom. Called also to welcome others to the Feast of the Lamb. Each week before we gather for communion, we say this thing called the Pledge of Love. It's an old practice handed down from the 16th century to Anabaptists. We say these words because we take seriously that what happens in this meal is that we are what we eat. This is a feast set before people for whom the veil has been lifted, who can finally see one another. If we're able to see among us a reflection of this hope, of people who we can say, I'm sorry when we've harmed, who commit to the difficult work of being both diverse yet one, of forgiving and making right, if we can do that here, perhaps there's hope for our world. Beloved, in a moment, I'm going to welcome you to receive these gifts of hope for those invited to the feast of justice and mercy, bound together in the reconciling life, death, and resurrection of Jesus.